And I can see why. Because when you do it that way, now you're using your wiring as a common mode device as opposed to a differential mode. Therefore, it's a lot easier to put the signal onto both wires, a co-phase signal onto both wires, and therefore easier to detect at the other end. I'm going to guess that that intermittent load device was a little bit like a buzzer, maybe a solid state equivalent, but a buzzer-like device, almost a doorbell, a 110-volt doorbell, so to speak, would be a beautiful interrupter. You'd be seeing all kinds of static across those contacts, and boy, would that make a signal along that wire and that could be detected. Does that sound close to what it might be, Chris? Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick. I think it's more along the line. Do the same function because it happens at a much higher rate, and I believe the little seeker unit, the little handheld probe, so to speak, was probably tuned to that. I never bothered opening it up or doing any measurements to find the actual frequency that the thing worked at, but it was definitely interrupted at a very, very high rate.
The probe itself, did it have a loudspeaker or a meter? How did you know when you get near the right wire?
It had a little speaker on it and also a line of LEDs in line with kind of a blunt plastic encased nose on it. So that basically you could shove it into a fuse box and not short anything out.
Yeah, when you find that one, Chris, I'd like to hear about it. That sounds like a fun machine to have. And it just sounds like a neat thing I'd like to have. So when you find out what brand name and model number, please come back and let us know. It doesn't have to be immediately. If you do it next week, that's more than soon enough, Chris. Rich, M2EO, go right ahead with your comment, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I had a question concerning the ongoing amplifier project, 12-8 microns.
Okay, you're on the list. Howie, I'm sorry to keep you waiting. Go right ahead with your comment.
I hope, am I okay? Am I noisy?
You sound beautiful. Please proceed.
I had a device, and it was made by the phone company. It was made by Western Electric. You clipped it on either a phone line or onto a power line, and then you walked along with this little device. It had a 1KC tone, and you would be able to hear it on the wiring. The linemen used to use it when they were trying to find phone wires or taps or whatever, or branches. It would actually generate a signal. It would work either on an active or a dead line. Go ahead, Dick.
Do you believe it was making a 1KC modulated RF wave, or do you think it was a 1KC square wave? And when you were using the probe, would it work when you were near the right line, or did you have to almost make contact to that line? Back to you, Howie.
You had to make practical contact. As you got closer to the line, it got stronger. It wouldn't radiate that much. You had to get almost right on top of the line. And it would work for about 100 feet. I think what it did, it had a 1KC repetition rate, and somehow it generated, generated noise on the line, or it did something inductively. I don't know how they did it, but you had to be almost right on top of it. You had to have a lot of coupling.
I vaguely remember also that Radio Shack had something they sold once called a signal squirter. For instance, if you were troubleshooting an AM radio, you would start at the final amplitude, the final audio amplifier. If it was a tube type, you would go to the control grid, and you would connect the signal squirter, and sure enough, you'd hear a buzzing sound coming out of the loudspeaker. And because this buzzing sound really was making impulses that covered the whole frequency spectrum of audio, IF, and RF, you could slowly work your way back in the radio, getting closer and closer to the front end, and eventually you're on the front end RF amplifier. And as you work your way back from loudspeaker toward the front end, when the signal stops, I found the dead signal, the dead stage, because as you work toward the front end, the radio is getting more and more sensitive, and therefore the signal should be getting louder and louder in the loudspeaker. I think they called it a signal squirter. I wonder if anyone remembers that particular device. Okay. It's my lousy memory. Alrighty. Hey, Paul, you brought a beautiful problem to our attention. You want to put in any closing comments on here, Paul? WS2N, AQRIW.
No, but thanks for the information, and very good. and yeah, we'll keep at it. All I wanted to do was put an extra light in, and I got bombed. But that's what happens, you know. A lot of things are discovered like that by accident. And I'm not really crazy about these light bulbs anyway, by the way. I had another one, another friend, another house there. And I know that my son-in-law's bulb was, I mean, you could hear it. You could hear the thing go, you know, almost like a 60-cycle tone to it, you know. Took that out and threw that away for a 440-watt bulb in its place. I'm not crazy about this, like, back to you now.
Yeah, I've got mixed emotions about the compact fluorescent light. The good news is they run very efficient. My guess is the one that gives you 75 watts of equivalent light output only draws maybe 20 or 30 watts of power. So it saves power. That's the good news. There's two or three pieces of bad news. One, they're quite a bit more expensive, even though they last a lot of hours. They're quite a bit more expensive to buy initially. Number two, they do make some radio noise. Number three, they do not give you full brilliance until you wait about a minute. So if that's the light that's supposed to go on for the cellar stairs, as you walk down the cellar stairs, rarely does a person have enough patience to flip the light, you know, go walking around the house for a minute, and then go down the cellar stairs and the light comes up to full brilliance. And another thing I don't like about them is that when you throw them away, they've got, only a milligram of, or 4 milligrams of mercury in there, but it's a toxic waste. So you got to be careful in how you dispose of them. So they're expensive, slow to respond, and hard to get rid of. One other thing. The one that I bought all 5 years ago, maybe it was very early, maybe it was brand X, but I plugged it into the kitchen light, and after using it for a few months, it went into a failure mode where the high voltage power supply inside literally caught on fire. I was awful glad when I was home when it happened. I don't think it would have burned down the house, but I have on occasion gone away from my house for a few days and left a particular light on. An ordinary fluorescent light bulb, they're pretty safe. If it burns out, no sweat. If it's one of these things where the power supply goes into a failure mode and starts a fire, there's a slim chance it could burn down your house. So there's some issues with these complex fluorescent lights. I know things are going to get better in time, but right now, I think there's some early growing pains. Maybe there are people with opinions on that one. I'm going to give a little bit of a delay and see if anyone wants to make comments on this subject before we close it out, and then I'm going to pick up with Rich. Anyone want to make any further comments? KQRIW on the deck net.
KQKEY, you can't dim them.
Yeah, Mel, and who said we can't dim them?
K2IF.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Chris. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yep, house burnt down here about 3 blocks away in July. Thought it was one of those top hats that, you know, these flush, these recessed lights. They use these, I guess, some kind of high-intensity wall lamps that, I don't know, what it runs off, 24 volts or whatever. People went away, left the light on, and started a fire in the ceiling, which spread that burnt the whole house down. So I guess there have been fire situations with some of these new lighting systems. One more comment I wanted to make. When you said Fluke has a probe. Yeah, Fluke, you know, makes a probe, Dick. I remember now we had one in the shop. What's it called? The 801 series probe, I think. Yeah, 801 something. I don't remember the last few numbers on it. It was an AC-DC probe. You connect it to your oscilloscope, and you can measure, I'm sure it went at least 100 amps AC or DC, Dick, but it was great because you can display it on a scope, put the scope on the DC, and measure just, you know, either by deflection, how many, you know, gradual up on the deflection, and read the current that way. Terrific probe, Dick, I remember it quite well. Very compact thing that clamped on, and like I say, connects directly to the scope over.
Yes, it connects directly to the scope, and it's a AC ammeter probe, clamp-on probe, without a doubt, no problem. To my knowledge, the only way you can measure DC is with a Hall effect device. The Hall effect device requires a power supply, so therefore there's got to be other power wiring to that clamp-on probe in order to measure DC and DC waveform. Do you remember there being a power requirement for that probe, Mel? Go ahead.
Oh, I don't remember that offhand now. I haven't, boy, it's been some years since I remember it. I saw it there. I didn't use it in years when I was there. I've been out of there now a few years. It was definitely AC-DC. It was marked right on the probe. Very, very nice. Fluke AC-DC. Definitely an AC-DC type of clamp-on device, Dick. Very small. Similar idea to the way that clamps on to the way Hewitt Packard does it, but a little bit more sleek, but definitely was AC-DC overcome.
Okay, sounds like I've got to do some more research into this one, because I do want to know what the waveform is. I'm trying to figure out this crazy solid-state amplifier that I'm working on. What is the relationship between drive power, output power, in the pulse mode, pulse RF mode, and what the average and peak and what the real waveform of current draw is, because I'm discovering that switching regulators, if for instance I've got a switching regulator that's good for 60 amperes max, and I'm only drawing an average of 58 amperes, it would make everything hunky-dory. Well, if the peak current goes to 90 and then goes to a much lower current in between, can the switching regulator handle it? Well, I found out the answer is no. The switching regulator, he doesn't care what the average current is. The switching regulator cares about what the peak current is, because he's got no real energy storage in there. If he had energy storage, he would be much more massive. He'd have to have great big filter capacitors and so on, which he doesn't have. And I'm going to have to add an extra filter capacitor on that particular switching regulator, because on top of that, the switching regulator, I can tell that he's flipping back and forth between a low-duty cycle and a high-duty cycle waveform on his switching rate. Maybe his switching rate is 50 kc. However, my pulse rep rate is coming out as an acoustic sound out of the switching power supply. So there's an acoustic problem to be discovered. Life is that simple. Okay, Rich, M2EO, what's the latest with your, that beautiful, was there someone else who want to make a comment?
Yeah, K2EO.
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, I've worked out of a whole bunch of amplifiers in my day, and normally Class C, obviously you need a lot of local storage, but I've also found that Class AB, where they run about maybe 10 to 20% of the final current value, need a lot of local storage. There's no way to get around that. The switching regulator is not going to have enough bandwidth in the loop to compensate.
Well, I do own a 100 ampere switching regulator, which handles it very nicely. But the problem with that particular one is that the voltage output is not adjustable. The other switching regulator I own is a 60 ampere job, but when I draw 90 ampere peak pulses, he droops a whole lot. So he doesn't have energy storage, and I've got to, and I can adjust his voltage, but I've got to add the extra energy storage that he needs, and I think I calculated a requirement for 30,000 microfarads, so it's going to be a nice, great big computer-grade capacitor running at 30 volts or 35 volts on the capacitor rating. It's a 28-volt power supply we're talking about. Okay, fun project, and lots of little details to worry about. And you got to worry about the shielding of a transmitter like that. One of the mistakes I made once is I decided to do some probing with a voltmeter. Just want to find out how many volts was on each one of the stages. And the dumb thing I did is not to have a load on the output of the transmitter. I wasn't putting any drive signal in, and I had no load at the output. As I connected my digital voltmeter probe to one of the gates of one of the early transistors, it supplied enough signal that somehow coupled from the output, which was 12 inches away, somehow enough coupling got fed back that the system broke into oscillation because there wasn't a load on the transmitter. The final stage got driven into infinity and wiped out one of the final transistors. And I thought those transistors could take anything. MRF-899s, they're really moosey transistors. But you run one of those with full B plus on it and full drive power on some frequency that it feels like oscillating on with no load, and you're really pushing your luck. I think this spec sheet says it'll take any phase angle of a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. I just happen to have an infinite standing wave ratio on this, and I burnt up some beautiful piece of silicon. What is it now called? Silicon nitride transistor. Thought you'd get a kick out of that one, Steve. Back to you.
HWW with a comment on the PS.
Should I let him go or not?
Okay, Steve first, go ahead.
Okay, you're going to find that a low frequency oscillation or anything a transient that's way slower than, let's say, the bandwidth of the amplifier is not going to provide enough, let's say, series inductance to limit the current. So you probably fried all the bomb wires within that transistor. You're going to find out that the transient current was probably several times with the what the transistor can actually handle, because there's no inductance at low frequencies. People design their bias network to bypass the RF at the RF frequency, but you don't bypass close to DC. It's pretty hard to do.
Yeah, and even the additional problem, Steve, is that the particular length of cable I had coming out of the amplifier, which didn't have a load at the far end, for all I know it was an odd number of quarter waves or an even number of half waves or whatever, the possibility exists that the four final stage saw a direct short circuit, and here I am driving him to infinity. So without a doubt, if I ever feel like dissecting, I'm sure I fried those bonding wires. Howie, go ahead.
Just want to make a comment. I've used switching supplies, and when I've used switching supplies on repeater transmitters, they generate noise, and they got me, one got me in trouble, not with the FCC, but with a couple of repeater owners that were nearby picking up the noise. Depending on what the load was, or depending on when you keyed up, those things would put out a Samlex supply. So I find that linear supplies are bulkier, but when it comes down to it, you get a much cleaner output on your transmitter.
It's too well.
Yeah, I agree with that. Go ahead, Steve.
I have a better solution. You want somewhat efficiency. Switch supply, I actually designed one that was like 93% efficient. Why not make a switching power supply? However, make it a couple of volts higher than what you really need. I'm not sure if you're designing this for somebody else as a consultant or not. But make a linear regulator, which I've done with several megahertz of bandwidth, using FETs basically as a series pass element. They have a lot of bandwidth. So why not do that? Just drop a little bit across the linear regulator and be done with that.
Yeah, what you're describing is called an electronic filter, Steve. Very crafty idea. The switching regulator, in my case, would say, say for instance, I want 28 volts output. I'd make it a 30 volt power supply. Then I would design myself a hex FET linear regulator, which is really an electronic filter. The hex FETs would be dropping the 30 volts down to 28. And as long as my instantaneous voltage coming out of the switching regulator never went down to, let's say, 29, and the switching in the linear transistors, can go down to a few tenths of a volt of a source drain drop when they're in the full game mode, the full-on mode, that electronic filter could do a beautiful job. And my guess is properly designed, that thing could give you, what, 40 or 50 dB of filtering of the switching rate of what comes out of the power supply. Is that approximately what you're able to achieve, Steve, go ahead?
Oh, I achieved more than that. I think I achieved more like 70 dB. Actually, according to PSPICE, I did. I left early before they actually built it, but I'm going to assume that it was probably in the order of 70 dB or something like that. A lot better than the linear regulars you buy. And it definitely went up to several megahertz. You know, I did a analysis, I made a breadboard, and I left the company.
That would be a fun project to follow through on. Yeah, that's something I got to worry about, because you start transmitting a whole lot of sloppy signals on 902, and your fellow amateurs will start coming down on you and saying nasty things, and the people with your chasing services will probably not be happy either. Okay, Rich, N2EO, you were about to tell us on the latest with your saga why can't I forget the brand name, of your beautiful amplifier you've been working on for some time. How's that going? N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Nick, N2EO. A little hard to talk tonight, but I'll do my best. It's the Meritron AL1500 that I've added a second tube to, and coming along rather well. Got a couple of questions, Dick. I am tuned the tubing that I'm going to be using to rewind 10 and 15 meter coil because of the increased power. The RF current is higher, the coil still gets not bad, but a little bit warm. My question is, with the larger diameter copper tubing that I'm using, I may have to use fewer turns to make the turn bigger in diameter to fit it in there. I wonder if that's going to affect the cue. And of course, tuning it, I'll use my poor man network analyzer to figure out the turns on it.
Nick.
Other things I've done here, I have some parts on order. I'm changing the fuses in the tank, zipping out the chassis with a zipping tool. I have a dual 30 amp gang air pack, 20 volt 30 amp breakers coming in. I'm filling over the circuit breakers on the back of the amp. And I'm also putting water in the switch. So I'm thinking this is cooling. Yes, which will shut the air down. And you've got to hold your fans. Same company that made the fans for Meritron seats that they make a higher capacity fan, same size.
At M2EL, welcome to the W2EL repeater.
Okay, I've got some pretty good news for you as I see it there, Rich. First of all, your inductor that's used in the PI output network for 10 and 15 meters has probably got taps on it. And as you operate your band switch, you're probably choosing the right tap. Even though that coil runs a little bit hotter because you're running two tubes instead of one tube, we've got to be realistic now as to what is a tolerable amount of extra heating or loss of signal. If I had a final stage tank network that had 0.5 dB of insertion loss because of some non-ideal characteristic, series resistance, wound on a sloppy piece of plastic that's got the dielectric loss to it, or whatever, 0.5 dB of loss is about 5% of your power. 1 dB of loss is close to 10%. 0.5 dB of loss is 5%. When you're running 1,000 watts, 5% is 50 watts. If your coil was dissipating 50 watts, it would probably melt. It doesn't have a natural heating, it doesn't have a natural heat sink in there. Yeah, it's a little bit larger diameter, and it's out in open air, but it's inside of a shielded cage, so it doesn't have a real simple local air supply to cool it. So the chances of it dissipating 50 watts, 50 watts, in my opinion, is pretty slim. You would see quite a bit of heating of that coil if it dissipated 10 or 20 watts, which is 10 or 20 watts of dissipation out of 1,000. The guy on the other end is never going to see the difference on his detonator. So even though the coil runs a little bit hot, as long as it's not coming to the point of discoloring its silver plating, if that's what it's got, or melting its solder leads, and consider using high-temperature solder, silver-bearing solder. So there's a slim chance that once you realize the numbers of what's going on, that the coil running a little bit hot may not be bad. Second of all, the Q of the coil is not what you think it is. You would think that the resistance of the coil would change its Q in your circuit. If you were measuring the Q of the coil itself as an independent element and you're using laboratory test equipment, a LRCQ meter made by Boulton, and you're measuring the coil itself, you can measure its Q. And the natural Q of the coil might be 500. But when it is in your particular circuit, and your circuit is properly adjusted with the tuning and loading control, it probably runs a Q somewhere between 10 and 15, loaded Q. The coil in its natural network of the PI network with the C1 capacitor on the input, the tuning capacitor, the C2 capacitor on the output, the loading capacitor, the resistive component of your antenna, and the resistive component of the tube on the other end. when you put all those resistive components in that circuit with that particular LC ratio and you properly align it, it's running a Q of 10 or 15. That doesn't mean the coil has a 10 or 15. It's the loading and the way it's in the circuit that gives it the Q. It's the loaded Q we're really talking about here. So the natural Q of your circuit, your coil itself, may already be, I'm going to pick a number, 300. And if you do what you're about to do, wind it on a with a larger diameter wire or copper tubing, maybe you can make the Q go to 600 instead of 300. But in the circuit, where it used to be a Q of 12, when it's properly loaded in the circuit, and you make all those changes, it's going to go to 12.3, because it's the loading of the circuit that determines the Q of it in operation. So with that, with all of that understanding, there's a 50-50 chance you don't have to change it. But if you do change it, the right way to change it is first to measure the diameter of the coils that are there now. Measure the spacing between the coils. Go to the Radio Amateur's Handbook under the section on inductors, the first couple of chapters, and there's a beautiful formula there where you plug in the number of turns, the spacing of the turns, and the diameter of the turns, and it'll tell you exactly how many nanohenry or microhenry is the coil that's there now. And when you wind your brand new coil, even though you're forced into a different diameter and a different length and a different pitch and whatever, if you reuse that formula, you'll be able to wind the new coil in such a way that it gives you the same inductance. That's what you want. The new coil, you want it to have the same inductance as the old coil so that your C1 tuning capacitor and your C2 loading capacitor don't run out of range when you're in the 10 or 15 meter band. So by way of that formula, if you're really sure you want to change it, you can make the new coil, even though it physically looks different, you can make sure it's got the exact same inductance. But I would go real slow and do a little bit more head scratching to find out, are you really losing that much power in that coil? I mean, that coil could be at the point of melting where it dissipates 30 watts, and 30 watts out of 1,000 or 1,500, percentage-wise, is awful small. And unless you're going to run T down for a half hour with a RIDI transmitter or a one of these Joe Taylor-type modes, unless you're going to run some very high duty factor mode, maybe the dissipation of the coil under real intermittent commercial amateur service is not so bad. So give it some thought, in my opinion there, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, well, what you say makes a lot of sense. My thoughts on the coil, before I changed the taps and got the taps correctly, I was discoloring the coil and melting solder. But since I got the 10, mainly the 10-meter tap, the 15 not so bad. But since I got the tap set properly, it settled down to the point where I can hold the key down for a period of time, shut the transmitter off, kill the voltage, go in there and touch the coil. It's uncomfortably warm, but not super hot.
Yeah, with that in mind, Rich, I think you don't have to change that coil. You could, if you want to, put a small local fan or drill a couple of holes in the chassis so that some of the air that's flowing around the tube now flows near that coil. And you could even go to a higher temperature solder. But if that coil is not running, if you can touch it, even though it's uncomfortably warm, an extremely light touch of a human finger can tolerate just barely 70 degrees centigrade. With a 50 or 70 degrees centigrade. An extremely light touch. A heavy touch would give you a blister. An extremely light touch with a human finger can just barely touch 70 degrees centigrade. Most metallic objects, particularly a coil with solder on it, 100 degrees centigrade is duck soup. 150 degrees centigrade, yeah, you're getting to the point where you've got to worry about the life of the circuit. So what I'm getting at is in degrees centigrade, most metallic objects can tolerate twice the degrees centigrade. That's not the twice the absolute temperature. Twice the degrees centigrade of what a human finger very lightly can touch. So with that in mind, and now that you've got the cap in the right place, and you found out how to properly set the tuning and loading controls, I think there's a medium good chance that the coil you've got there is adequate. And once everything else with the amplifier has been brought up to snuff, and once your ConEd wiring with your buck boost transformer has been installed and everything else is perfect, and you want to do some fine tuning, consider making the coil out of a wide tape of silver-plated brass material or flattened copper tubing, small-diameter copper tubing that you flatten and wind it into a tape-like, I don't mean tape, but you know what I mean, a wide ribbon-like thing would be a very efficient way of making the coil if you want that last little bit of efficiency. But the guy in the other end, you're going to be doing it for pride. The guy in the other end is not going to see the difference on his S-meter, Rich. But the scientist that's inside of every true ham radio operator, they like everything to go at near maximum efficiency if they can get it, and I know where you're coming from. N2EO, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, thank you. This is even that. It's just that, you know, where I cut the straps from the coil because they were unsoldered with braids. You know, it doesn't look very good, but it's not very pretty where I've soldered everything. So I thought I'd make a coil from scratch and find the tabs and then move Jeff between them. I not only silver bearing solder, but drill holes and put brass screws from the straps to the coil. I don't know, I'll give it a little bit of a stick. Anyway, if there's more time, go on to the next person. I do have some questions on that bus loop. Maybe if PNJ is around, he's an electrician, he might be able to use the help. But go on to the next person, Dick. In 2 weeks.
Okay, Rich. Sounds like a fun project you got there. Something that'll, that'll keep you off the streets at night. I know there's a pun there somewhere. Okay, Paul, I think it's time you tell us about the Dawn spacecraft that was launched last Thursday. And from what I read, when you go to the proper NASA sites on that one, boy, that's an exciting sounding project, where it's going to spend 3, 4, or 5 years of nearly continuous thrusting with a ion engine that runs 10 times higher in thrusting efficiency compared to a chemical engine. I think they said in one of the articles, the total thrust you get out of one of these engines is equal to the force of a piece of nice notebook paper pressing down on your hand. That's the force that you get. However, when you use a chemical engine, you make a burn, as they call it, for, you know, 15 seconds, whereas this thing is going to burn for 5,000 hours. So although it's a small amount of force, it's doing it with extremely high efficiency, running on the solar cells for the raw power to accelerate all of those xenon molecules. Xenon's a very heavy gas, and that's they got a whole lot of gallons of liquid xenon on the aircraft that gets pumped into this ion engine. The ion engine breaks it up into positive ions and negative ions. It squirts the positive ions out with a few thousand volt power supply, and then it also, after that, squirts out the negative ions just to make sure that the spacecraft doesn't build up a high positive charge. Because if you think about what would happen, a high negative charge, if you didn't squirt out the negative electrons, eventually the spacecraft would build up such a high charge that by electrostatic attraction, it would take all of that exhaust gas that you've squirted out there in space and eventually start attracting it all back again, and you would lose your thrust. Nasty things would happen. So you don't want your spacecraft to end up with zillions of volts ahead of positive or negative, so to speak. You want everything to stay neutral. But it sounds like a fun project. And I think this is one of the first times in the history of NASA where they're going in orbit around one body. I think it's Ceres is the name of the asteroid that's midway between Mars and Jupiter. They're going to go in orbit for a year or two around one asteroid. Then they're going to leave that orbit and go to another asteroid and go into orbit around that one. That's the first time in the history of NASA they've done this. Maybe I've taken some of the wind out of your sail. Sorry about that, Paul. But that's how much I've read so far. Sounds like an exciting project. WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW in the TechNet. Hello, Paul. I wonder if you're still there.
Still here, Dick. Stand by one.
Roger, Dodger. Worried me a little bit.
Okay, very good. Yeah, just said that for a minute. Heard you call me. Did you ask a question regarding the Dawn spacecraft?
Boy, did I. I gave a 1.5 minute introduction about the fact that it's got an ion engine that produces very little force, but it's going to do it for 5,000 hours. But this is the first time that NASA has ever made a spacecraft that's going to go in orbit for a year or so around one body, and then go out of that orbit and blast itself into the orbit of another body, another asteroid. Cirrus, I think, is the first asteroid. I forget the name of the second asteroid. One of those asteroids has a whole lot of water in the form of ice, and the other one's dry as a bone, and they think it may have gone through a molten stage where all the iron has sucked to the center of that particular asteroid. And I think the asteroid is 500 miles in linear length, one of them. So these are rather big objects that this thing's going to go in orbit around. It's not a planet. I guess it's not even a planetismal. It's an asteroid. But it's going to go from one asteroid to another. An exciting sounding project this Dawn. So give us your take on what's going to happen. I think the very first encounter, it was launched last Thursday. I think the first encounter is sometime in the year 2011. And then I guess a couple of years after that, it finally goes to the second body. WS2N, K2RIW, the second end.
Okay, yeah, this was the mission. It was delayed originally. They had some lightning problems, and they stopped fueling it because bad weather at the time. And then by the time it got pushed back, it was going to interfere with one of the shuttle missions, and then they finally got it off of a launch pad, yeah, like last week. It's going to visit Vista and Cirrus, and two asteroids. And like you said, 2011 will go into orbit around Vista, deorbit, and then go around to Cirrus, 2015. So, first time they'll have some spacecraft go into orbit, and then deorbit, and go into orbit around something else. Unless you want to consider going to the moon and then orbiting Earth. They really never did that. That would be, it would be the first time, because when they come back from the moon, they don't orbit the Earth. They go directly right in through the atmosphere on all the Apollo missions. So, yeah, that would be the first time that they've done something like that. Ion engines. Yeah, not one, but three ion engines. There was a spacecraft that was launched a while back with an ion engine on board. And that was the first prototype of something like that. Now this one has three ion engines on board. It's going to run thousands and thousands of days out of all these years that it's going to be running. A little over half of those years, the engine will be on. And each engine produces as much thrust, they say, as if you take a piece of paper or a printing paper and put it in your hand, that kind of weight. But now, if that thing is on all the time, eventually you would be able to push this 1,000-pound craft on and on to higher speeds. It's got a 35-amp system. It's got solar panels, good size solar panels too, nickel hydride batteries, each engine is like only like 20 pounds, very light, and it takes on the electricity from the into the batteries from the solar cells, charges it up and uses the ion system to propel neon gas. That's what they use. Neon is a heavy gas, same substance in the camera, flash bulb. That's the kind of gas that they use to exhaust. I know it's got a 5-foot dish for an antenna, and also a low-gain antenna. And I have tons of information on it, but I think that's pretty much what you're going to need. So it's going to go through a Mars gravity assist to get to the first asteroid. And then that will help it also increase its speed. I remember reading the amount of speed that this thing increases. It's something like 60 miles an hour, first 60 miles an hour, you know, 0 to 60, the equivalent of doing something like that, I think takes like 10 days or something. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, some of those speeds, when you look at all of the burn time of all of the ion engine, one of the articles says that the total amount of thrust increase they're going to get throughout this whole mission is equivalent to a speed increase of 25,000 miles an hour by way of those ion engines. But it's going to be spread out over 5 or so years. The exhaust gas is xenon, xenon plasma. You take the xenon liquid or gas and break it up into positive and negative ions. You accelerate the positive ions out of the rocket engine. That's the main thrust. And the positive ions are the nucleus of the xenon gas molecule. That's where 99% of the mass is, of a xenon molecule, maybe 99.99. And then later on, you squirt out the electrons. They don't give you very much thrust to squirt out the electrons. You're doing that just to make sure that the spacecraft stays neutral. But the total amount of efficiency, the specific impulse, is the method by which you measure efficiency of a jet engine. In other words, how many pounds of fuel you burn and how much thrust you get by what length of time. And the faster you can make the gas come out, the more thrust you're getting. It's very similar to you sitting on a very low friction car on a smooth little floor, and you've got a 5-pound weight in your hand. And you throw the 5-pound weight slowly, and you'll move the car backwards a little bit. If you throw the 5-pound weight very rapidly, like if you make it like a slingshot, like these shot put experts, and you put a lot more thrust into the thing you're throwing, you're going to get a lot more speed out of your car. You're going to move backwards in the other direction. So this ion engine spits out the xenon molecules at 25 miles per second, which turns out to be 89,000 miles an hour, is the velocity of the gas coming out of the ion engine, the xenon positive nucleus and positive ions. In theory, you can't get anywhere near that velocity out of a rocket engine, because the main speed you get out of the nozzle of an ordinary chemical rocket engine is a function of how much temperature can you tolerate. And the temperatures that would be required would be melting down the rocket engine. So a rocket engine can't give you anywhere near that amount of thrust efficiency, which is called specific impulse. So those are some of the numbers that I measured. Okay, Vistor, I think, is the one that they believe has a iron core. They believe at one time it was a molten device, a molten 500-mile-long space object. I think it's a potato-shaped object, but I'm not sure. I don't think it's completely round. And 500 miles, I think, is the longest dimension. And they believe it was one time molten, and the iron has sunk to the center during the time it was molten, very similar to what happened with the Earth. That helped us make the magnetic field. And so the distribution of mass inside of Vista is going to be studied by studying the trajectory of the Dawn spacecraft as it flies by Vista and goes into orbit around Vista. The specific path it takes will tell you what is the distribution of the mass within Vista. Vista, I think, is very dry, whereas when they finally go to Ceres, I believe they said that it has, a mile or two thickness of ice on the surface. And where in the world did the water come from that created the ice on Vista? Correction, on Ceres, if I got that correct, Paul. I wonder if you heard any hints on all of that. And that 5-foot dish, is that going to communicate back to us on probably NASA's X-band frequency, which I think is around 8.4 gigahertz. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, most of the deep space probes are all 8.4 in that area. I didn't read much about the asteroids themselves. They're just a mission. So I really don't know much about that. Cirrus, I think, is now considered a... I think they do consider it a planet. Not a planet, but planetismal. I think because of this Pluto deal, dropping Pluto, because of the size of this thing, I think this thing qualifies. There's some kind of a technical thing with Cirrus. I believe it might be a different one. Isn't Cirrus the big one that was discovered in the late 1800s? If that's the one, that's the same one we're talking about. And after this, I just want to mention about STS-120 coming up at the end of October. Back to you.
I think so. I think Cirrus is the one that was discovered in the 1800s. And give us some words on STS-120.
Okay, yeah, the 23rd of October, I think, is going to be taking off. The 7-person crew, woman commander, and they're going to be going to the International Space Station. They're going to bring with it something similar to what they brought up before. It's called a node. The node that's up there is Unity, and Unity is it's a six-sided... ports around a big gigantic can is really what it is. So you have one end of the can, one at the other end, and then a four surrounding the cylinder part, and that's where a lot of things hook up to the Destiny Lab and the Russian Zarya cargo piece of the International Space Station. You've got the Quest Lab hooked up to it. Well, at the end of Destiny right now, that's where they dock the space shuttles. And you have a pressure mating adapter there attached to it, and that's how the shuttle attaches to the space station. Well, they're going to bring up this other node, they call it, instead of Unity, they gave it the name Harmony. Now, these things are big. It's 24 feet long. So it's like the length of a long room. And again, the 14-foot diameter, famous 14-foot number. This is a heavy thing. This thing weighs 30,000 pounds, like 10 of my cars. And they're going to bring it up in the cargo bay and attach it in a temporary location. It's actually going to attach it to the Unity module temporarily, so Harmony will be attached to it. And the reason for that is where they want to put it is where the space shuttle now docks to Destiny. They're gonna leave it there. When the space shuttle leaves, they're going to use the robotic arm on the space station to relocate this Harmony Unity structure and put that at the end of Destiny. They're going to have to disconnect the pressure mating adapter first, and then attach this Harmony piece, both in Italy, by the way, and from that, they'll be able to bring up future components. Now you'll have, that'll be bolted in, now you'll have 5 ports. You know, for instance, off of one port, you'll be able to bring up the Columbia module at another living quarters being built by European Space Agency, and then the Kaibab piece, that's another living area that's going to be brought up, being built by Japan. That'll be followed up next year. The Columbus piece is going to be at the end of this year. And then once that's... you still have a couple more ports. The front port will have the pressure mating adapter on it for the shuttle to dock. And that's the way that whole setup works. So working your way back, let's say the dock, after this is all done, you have the pressure mating adapter. After that, you'll have the Harmony structure, the Harmony
In line with that is the Destiny Lab. In line with that is the Unity node. Very similar, almost the same thing as the Harmony node that they're bringing up. And then behind that you have the Russian functioning cargo block. That's another big room that was first launched for the initial piece of the International Space Station. And behind that you have the Russian module, living area. And of course behind that you have the Russian docking port for the Soyuz. And that's pretty much the configuration that they're going to have. It's a 14-day mission, and people say, well, what are they going to do? They're going to drop off this Harmony. They're going to drop off an astronaut to stay on the space station and bring one home. What are they going to do for 14 days? That, to me, is a real mission. That's where they're going to relocate the solar array that's been up there since 2000, called the P6, or Port 6 trust structure with this solar array. That's going to be relocated down the end of the International Space Station, all the way at the end, in the, past the, an existing solar array, and that'll be bolted up there. That's going to be the primary work of the STS-120 mission. Back to you, WS2M.
If I listen to the weight of the things that are being installed and the future things that are going to be installed, it's mind-boggling. In the past, the heaviest thing I know of that was ever put into orbit around Earth was the Russian Mir space station. I just looked up on Google and it told me that, like Wikipedia is telling me that the total mass of the Mir was 250 tons. And I'm guessing that the International Space Station is far in excess, when it's going to be completed, of 250 tons. You may know what the total mass is predicted to be, Paul, and one very simplistic philosophy is whatever goes up must come down. It ain't going to stay there forever. So someday all of this jazz, all of this mass of metal and other materials is going to be re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. Has anyone ever talked about what is the process through which we're going to get all of this stuff back safely? So question number one is, what's your guess? Is the International Space Station going to be two or three times what the final Mir was? And Mir was 250 tons. And have they ever started talking about how it's all going to come back, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, is that that?
Yeah, I heard a million tons. That's four times the amount. There you go. And as far as this thing coming back, I've heard that they wanted to eventually deorbit piece by piece to some degree and dump it into the Pacific Ocean. Lifetime of the space station was supposed to be 15-20 years, but starting one, this thing was supposed to be completed in 2003, I think it was, 2004 time frame initially. So there's pieces up there that have been up there since 2000. When Unity first docked with the functioning cargo block, the Zarya module, are they going to start then? In other words, 8 years from now, 7-8 years from now, they're going to start deorbiting stuff. I think that's unlikely. Mir was supposed to be only maybe a 5-year program, and I think one went 15-20 years, so that's probably what will happen here. I can't see them starting to end the mission as soon as they finish it. That doesn't make sense. And I don't know, what was the Skylab? That was pretty heavy too. I don't remember the weight of that thing. And then of course the weight of all the Apollo launches. They really put up some heavy weight with those, but it's different. They take these pieces up and put them together, and you put 20-30 missions together like that, and you've got a lot of weight up there. It's got to be by the time they're done over a million tons. Back to you, WS time.
Okay, we may have some slip decimal places here. Mir was 250 tons. If the total weight of the International Space Station is four times that, it would be 1,000 tons or 2 million pounds. A Mir at 250 tons was half a million pounds. So when you say a million, do you mean a million pounds? Or do you mean 2 million pounds, four times Mir, which would be 1,000 tons? Back to you, Paul.
Okay, four times Mir, whatever that was. Million pounds sounds right. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Mir is 250 tons. Four times that would be 1,000 tons, which would be 2 million pounds. 2 million pounds, 1,000 tons. Four times Mir. I think you're saying that's most likely the weight. And I guess you're saying that you've occasionally heard talk of deorbiting individual modules and dropping them into the Pacific Ocean. Some number of decades downrange. That's approximately the story of all.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a 15, 20 year lifetime of this thing, but you know the way it goes. Mir was supposed to be, what, 5 years, and that went 15 or 20, so that's probably what will happen.
Yeah, I think Mir was originally put up around 1984, and when did it come down? A little bit before 2000? Roughly when did Mir come down?
Yeah, it was before 2000. Probably 1998, 97. I don't know, Dick, but yeah, probably around that time.
Okay. And so, the International Space Station, when did it really get started? I would guess around 1995, go ahead, or 96, 97. Did it get started before Mir came down? Go ahead.
Right around the same time. Soon after Mir was down, there was nothing up there. And then they put the Russian cargo block up, they called Zarya, and they put the Unity together. That was done in 2000, I believe. Probably 1999, maybe. Because soon after that, they bought up the living quarters for the Russians. That's the living quarters. And then they had three pieces attached. Then the time went on. They were able to occupy it at that time. The guy Shepard was the American commander. And then they had a Russian on board. And once that piece was docked, they've had people living on that thing ever since. Mostly three people, but after Columbia, two people. And we're up to 7 years of, almost 7 years of constantly living on the International Space Station. Back to you.
Yeah, I tried Google first year of International Space Station, and I didn't get a clear answer to that yet, but I'm guessing it's just before the year 2000, maybe just before Y2K. I vaguely remember somebody worrying about whether or not Y2K was going to affect the International Space Station. Let's see if I just say year of International Space Station. See if Google will give me an answer to that in a nice, clear form. And no, it doesn't. Too complicated a question apparently. Somebody got an answer?
How I implicate it to Google. Try International Space Station year launched. See what you get.
Good suggestion. Stand by a second.
There's a difference between when it was first manned and the first two pieces. They docked automatically there, so you have to be careful.
The first article I found says that at the end of this year, the International Space Station will be capable of doing this and that. Doesn't tell you what year. Somebody wrote a current article.